Doctor Who.
Okay, we just saw Angels Take Manhattan, starring Karen Gillan, Arthur Duvall, Alex Kingston, Michael McShane, and of course, Matt Smith as the Doctor.
Bunch of people in that one.
And Michael McShane, interesting because he's in just about everything. So we see him here, and he's a little bit older than I remember him.
Oh, yeah.
From the 90s and later. You know, yeah. Interesting seeing him in Doctor Who, though.
Well, it's always good to see him in anything. Well, it's cool seeing anybody when they show up in Doctor Who, for that matter.
And Alex Kingston, of course, who is River Song, also played in ER, and she's an accomplished actress. This seems to be, like, because of the way that her story rounded out, she was meeting the Doctor during the last part of her story and him from the beginning.
Right.
So everything was crisscrossed, the Doctor's wife, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm not sure how much more of her we're going to be seeing.
Yeah, I know that with the newest episodes, it just she's already been completely forgotten about, the two episodes that have come on since then. So, but yeah, I don't know. It is weird to think about the fact that they talk about all the time that they spent together, yet we haven't seen any period of time where they've been together for a prolonged period without us seeing it, though. You know, I mean, they have the journal that they kept together that they talk about with David Tennant, and you know, we haven't seen any hint of that time period taking place yet, unless that's one of those things that got rewritten somehow. But in which case, I don't know. I don't know how they're going to play that in.
You know, his first kiss, she was concerned was going to be her last kiss.
Yeah.
You know, and I think we hear in one other episode the Doctor talk about how his nights are with her.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I can't even imagine that from Matt Smith, who plays an innocent, yet malevolent character so often. And to see, I mean, Alex Kingston is wonderful as an actress, but the part that she plays in Doctor Who seems to be at odds with the type of person that the Doctor would be with.
I definitely could like picture him being with someone as adventurous, but she seems like even more of a troublemaker than I would expect for him. Not that he's not a troublemaker, but I think his troublemaking is kind of inadvertent, whereas she seems to be a little bit more blatantly intentional about being a troublemaker, I guess.
And that strikes a chord too, because we've had those intentional companions before.
Yeah.
We have had Ace and Leela, who both, I mean, Ace
obviously
with her little bombs that she would make, and Leela, the Doctor, was always telling her to put her knife away.
Yeah.
So it seems like it would be the type of character that he would stay away from, not the character that he would be attracted to.
Yeah, especially not somebody he would marry. Even if it was for the sake of saving a life, it's still just, I don't know.
Right.
And then to have all the banter about being married, too, not just knowing that they are.
Yes, husband.
Yeah, you know, it's not really who I would have expected to see in that position.
No. But anyway, moving on, the Doctor has they start off, of course, in New York City in Manhattan, and Sam Gardner, a character that's quickly forgotten after he meets his older self, sort of like to set the foundation for what we're going to see later on in the episode, when his older self meets his younger self, and he says, "I'm you," which is interesting to me because in previous Doctor Who, when we've seen characters meet each other, we've seen an explosion when the Brigadier met the Brigadier
in
a Peter Davison episode with Tegan. And so it just seems to me odd that it seems Doctor Who rules don't follow that anymore.
I have the feeling that part of it's because, again, to bash Moffat the way I've been doing it last time too, but I think it's kind of Moffat takes a lot of liberties with individual stories, intentionally going against canon, but not being overly concerned with following rules that have been set.
Terry Styx and Robert Holmes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, stuff like that, and maybe even just the fact that, whatever it was that River says about that there are all kinds of displacements all over the place in the city. you know, maybe because of what the angel had done, maybe that kind of gives it a loophole to, like, get away with the story. Right. I mean, there's a whole other point to that, which I don't know if you're going to bring up later.
Yes,
but
I'm planning on it.
I'm sure. So I'll leave it for that for later.
No, it's a perfect segue, so just go with it.
Okay.
It's just, very interesting that New York would be unsettleable for the TARDIS because there would be too many distortions in New York. And I've been to New York plenty of times. The hotels, first of all, don't have that nice red carpet.
No, that's for sure.
Very faded.
Yes.
Most of New York City is old, and we get a glimpse of that in certain archways that Rory goes through later on. And it's absolutely a beautiful city. Mm-hmm. And we see the Central Park view from there, and it's just, when she says that, you can't land the TARDIS here. It's a literary device, obviously. Yeah. But there is that age in New York City that I think a lot of cities don't. I mean, London would be the oldest, and St. Petersburg or a place like that, you know, where they're just very old anyway.
Yeah, other than that, though, I mean, you know,
if London doesn't have time distortions.
Yeah, well, that's a whole nother thing that was kind of funny. Yeah, between that and just his comment about, you know, Amy asks what's going on. He said, I don't know. It's New York. Like, what? New York is the only place that you don't understand out of all time and space that you travel through?
Yeah, yeah. New York is the alien landscape that they're unaware of.
Yeah, and it's just, it's kind of silly, and I guess in a way. But other than that, just in general,
Well, see, too, I think they had to stretch a little bit to make some kind of lightheartedness about this episode, because there is a sullenness about this episode, because we know we're going to see Rory and Amy for the last time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there isn't, like in the next episode, The Snowman, where you have sort of like this, the Santarin making dry jokes and the Doctor playing off of that and Vestra making jokes. You have that all set up, whereas here it's just so serious, especially when it comes to the Weeping Angels.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they've always been a very troubling enemy. Anytime they've been around the Angels, it's always been a very, very intense episode, at least as far as the conflict that exists. Yeah. So that, I guess, it's part of that, just trying to, like you said, make it a little bit more lighthearted, considering the fact that it's their last episode and the fact that it's an Angels episode. You know, the end of the season, too, for that matter. So there's a lot that they tried to, a lot of emotion packed into that episode.
I come to this podcast as with some trepidation, too, because of just the bleakness that this episode, it's always in at night, except when the Doctor's reading from the book.
Right.
And when he gets back to the page. Mm-hmm. And there's a shadow, a pall cast on the episode, and it's not one that's easy discussion when it comes to Amy or Rory leaving.
Either. I know I get that he's trying to pick up on some of the film noir aspects of, you know, 1930s New York, but
yeah, that I'm gonna fill you just kind full of lead, you know, plug you full of lead.
I think did a good job, just as far as, you know, getting the right car, getting the right kind of suits for the people that, you know, were there. And I don't know,
I'm disappointed that I missed seeing them in New York City, you know,
being so close. Yeah, exactly. We're not even a half an hour outside of the city, and we didn't even get to see them when they were here or anything, but oh well.
Yeah.
It's all right. Only so many Americans are actually Doctor Who fans that actually got to see it. Unfortunately, most of them probably started at Eccleston. No offense to anybody hearing this that started at Eccleston.
When you think of Doctor Who, what do you think of? Tom Baker, scarf and the hat.
Exactly, scarf and the hat.
And after that, I guess, David Tennant, a lot of fans. David Tennant, Eccleston had the one season. But anyway, we're straying away.
Yes.
Let's get back to the episode. It's the we see the Statue of Liberty image here. Made me think, of course, you know, of Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
And but this time, the Statue of Liberty is a weeping angel with the fangs and everything. And I guess it's a neat image, you know, whenever you see the statue representing hope and
And then all of a sudden here it is trying to capture people or even eat them alive. It kind of looks like as it's sitting there leaning its mouth against the top of the building. But, the thing that's always funny to me, though, I was thinking about it when we were watching it. Why is it that's the only angel that's not made out of stone?
And it was made by the French, so maybe they're having their
yeah, little... so who knows? Maybe actually, maybe there is stone underneath it, and it's, I don't know.
It could be a British joke on the French.
Maybe. That would make sense.
We see the French hotel.
Yeah.
The Winter Key.
Yeah, the Winter Key. Definitely a French word. So, yeah, who knows? Yeah, maybe it is all leading into each other. I don't know. I don't know.
We hear the doctor say that he hates endings. This is not new to the doctor.
No,
so he rips out
not.
The last page of the book.
Mm-hmm.
And we see the last Centaurian.
Mm-hmm.
And down in the basement, this struck me as interesting because... Not to get off topic about not wanting to say goodbye. I mean, we saw that with Sarah Jane and the way Sarah Jane was. And David Tennant, between Tom Baker saying goodbye to Sarah Jane and sort of just dropping her off at the wrong block, and David Tennant saying goodbye to Sarah Jane.
Yep.
This time, Doctor, say goodbye. Say goodbye for real. Don't. And he didn't want to. But then him saying, my Sarah Jane, which was so heartwarming,
yep.
I thought. We get a little preludes to the unhappy endings that is about to come with Rory and Amy.
Yep.
Now we see the last Centaurian go down into the basement, and Riversong doesn't object to this, it seems. I'm not sure why she doesn't flip out when her dad...
Yeah, you definitely think that there'd be a little bit more resistance to that. I mean, especially as her, the woman who supposedly killed the doctor. And, definitely not being afraid to be outspoken about what she feels and, you know, what she wants done. But, straight up just, like, watching, like, nothing happens.
Exactly.
Oh, okay, you're going to put him down there with a bunch of, you know, baby angels? Oh, okay, yeah. You know, maybe she had it in her head, whatever, he survived 2,000 years locked in a crypt, you know. I guess he'll be okay against a bunch of stone angels or something, but...
That he's still living plastic and he's part Auton?
Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe she was figuring that would be the case. Not to say that spoils the actual ending of the episode or anything like that, but...
Right. I guess for Rory to die at 82 is really kind of a joke.
Yeah, well, that's it's a bit of a smack in the face to, you know, the existing storyline of him being somebody who's not going to die. But I guess, same thing, literary device again. You know, I don't know what the point was of skipping any kind of emotion from her, but I guess Moffat had an idea for it.
Yeah, it's interesting that Rory does eventually, you know, pass away. We don't actually see it, so I mean, it's
yeah, because obviously enough the timeline changed from, you know, his death that they witnessed, because he didn't die alone, you know.
Right.
I mean, even to the point where like the headstone had both of their names on it, so it was enough of a I guess they lived enough of a life together that, you know, they were able to share a headstone, you know, a grave site and everything like that.
So where do you think they live? Did they live? They didn't live in this bubble because that paradox was destroyed.
Well,
right?
No, so. Exactly. I mean, that's the idea, I guess. I guess the idea is that it was destroyed.
So,
I mean, at the same time, you know, the, I guess that graveyard was in New York.
Yeah.
I don't really know that they specified that, but you know, that's a good question, actually. Where did they actually live out their existence?
So Melody Malone must have spoken to Amy after that to get her book written. So Amy must have become a publisher, is what the inference was at the end of the episode. So interesting that River Song couldn't use her vortex manipulator to take Rory and Amy back.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's another one of the things that bothers me about the episode is, you know, she hints about the vortex manipulator.
Yeah, it's like riding a bike through traffic while the TARDIS is, I guess, a full-size car.
I guess. I guess is the point, though, is when you have something that's infinitely shaped, infinitely sized, that, you know, having your little manipulator makes it that much easier. But, yeah, I don't know. I don't really get the point of the way that they wrap that up with the whole idea of her going back to tell Amy to add the afterword.
This is the thing with Doctor Who that bothers me when they try to finish things is like David Tennant's death.
Yep.
All of a sudden, at one episode, he shakes the radiation into his shoe.
Yep.
And he gets it out of his shoe.
Uh-huh.
And then later on, of course, I guess it's too much for him. There's this most ancient civilization of all time. He gets radiation poisoning as William Hartnell.
Yep.
In the first Dalek episode.
Mm-hmm.
And he's still has some kind of radiation sickness. The universe is rife with radiation. Yeah. That's the vibration of the universe is radiation.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not a doctor or a physicist, but
but we know it's commonplace. I mean, right. You know, if you research it a little bit, so but
so it's interesting to me that the oldest civilization in the universe, the Gallifreyans, don't have a pill or a.
I mean, even we have a pill. We have radiation poison, you know. But yeah, maybe they figured as Gallifreyans, they didn't have to worry about it. Or maybe that's the point. Maybe there's structures on Gallifrey where
it just, you know, it kind of clashes with my sense of realism.
Yeah.
When I okay, you're trying to get rid of an actor or a you know, like they did Harry Sullivan after the first season with him, Ian Martyr's character and Tom Baker's first episodes, because they thought Graham Crowden was going to be the Doctor, so they wrote in a character who was strong.
Yep.
And sort of like an Ian, William Russell character for William Hartnell's Doctor. Someone who could get the job done, like Captain Jack is, you know, the muscle.
Yeah, yeah.
So Ian Martyr's character was written out during the second season of Tom Baker under similar circumstances. Mm-hmm. So it bothers me.
Yeah. No, there's definitely, it's like... I don't remember if it was Moffat David Tennant's episode or if that was still Russ Davies, but yeah, again, going back to the whole idea of changing what rules have already been put in place to dictate a specific story. You know, again, going back, like you said, going back to David Tennant, the whole thing of he was able to turn around the course of history and, like, you know, the time war was undone, but then all of a sudden, you know, you said David Tennant, the Doctor, you know, getting sick from dying from radiation poisoning. You know, still had enough time to go around and visit everybody before he actually died and managed to not irradiate anybody else next to him. But, you know,
again, did he have it in his shoe?
Oh, maybe that's what it is. Maybe he already shook it down. We just figured instead of taking it out this time, he'd leave it there. Yeah. I don't know. But
it's that's why I enjoyed John Pertwee's regeneration because of that. There was no, there wasn't a compromise when it came to how he died. He died because of. Mm-hmm. What, the spider in the Planet of the Spiders?
Yep.
He was with the, what was it called? The blue... Oh, now I'm going to hurt myself later. Anyway.
Yeah.
Every single cell in his body needed to be regenerated because of that.
Yeah.
And the radiation just... the Doctor knows that he's susceptible to radiation.
Yeah.
He'd think he would take some kind of precaution against that. But nevertheless, you don't see the Doctor eat. You don't see the Doctor sleep. You don't see the doctor.
So maybe he doesn't take precautions. Yeah, exactly.
He doesn't take his meds.
Exactly. Well, I guess when you're that old and you're allowed to be senile, you know, it's like whatever. It'll just
a psychotic.
Exactly. That's right. Psychotic. Yeah, psychotic. Yeah. So yeah, we got proof too. Maybe she's actually a
psychopath.
That's one psychopath per TARDIS. But maybe just skips an awful lot of things that he's supposed to be doing or something like that.
He's missing out. He's missing out on a lot of good. Oh, but he does cook, right? We see.
Oh yeah.
Well, Amy Pond, she cooks his first meal when he's. Yeah. But it's like he only eats when he starts his regeneration process.
I guess. Yeah, maybe that's all it is. Yeah. So he's either very energetic or very hungry, I guess. Yeah. You know, think of Tom Baker jumping around, you know, acting like a nutcase, you know, when he first regenerated into him.
Mother.
Yeah.
Mother, I feel sick. Send for the doctor. Quick, quick, quick.
Yep, yep. Speaking of Tom Baker, actually going back to the whole regeneration thing, talk about the fact that, you know, his falling off and what caused his regeneration.
Oh, well, yeah. You know, it was 7 years of Tom Baker and they wanted to say goodbye. And Tom Baker didn't want to say goodbye because Tom Baker is the Doctor.
Yep. Yep.
And so he loses his grip on a little structure. He's climbing the tower and he loses his grip and falls.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I guess the idea is he landed on his back. He broke his back or something like that. So he broke enough of his bones in his body that he couldn't just fix them. He had to go and regenerate. Although the Watcher was hanging out, so that was a whole other point. But we'll talk about that if we ever go back to that episode.
Peter Davison too. Interesting little side note here. When River Song has her hand in the angel, no, the angel has her wrist, and the Doctor basically says, you break it. To get out. I'm not helping you because I'm more concerned with Amelia. Mm-hmm. And the last page that he read, Amelia's farewell,
in
the chapter list.
Mm-hmm.
River is very upset. very mad.
Yeah.
Because he chose, from what it sounded like, the 12-year-old little girl.
Yep.
Rather than his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And there seems, she later says, never let him see the damage and never let him see you age. He doesn't like endings.
Yep.
So she knows what to expect, I think, upcoming.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I haven't really seen River age yet.
No, not really. Yeah. At least not, you know, at least they don't portray it as her having aged at all.
Right.
You know, whether he perceives her to age or not, I don't know. But at the same time, it's tough to keep a hold on some of that stuff anyway, because there was supposed to be 200 years lapsed before the impossible spaceman or something like that. The doctor was off by himself for that period of time. So who knows? Maybe he's even lost track of how to tell how old people are or something
like that. At the same
time,
200 years can go by, but at the same time, he says, how do you people live going moment for moment? He doesn't understand it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like when he was waiting for the box to open and the little cube episode,
right.
Yep. And he's painting and he's mowing the lawn and he's,
mm-hmm.
you know, playing.
Bouncing the ball or whatever. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
How do you people live
just
like
waiting.
This?
Yep. Yep.
Which makes it even funnier in the next episode in the snowman that he just kind of hangs out on his cloud and reads.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, very true. Yeah, I guess maybe after all of what happened, he was traumatized into wanting to slow down or something. I really don't think he's ever slowed down before. You know, other than that, so.
No,
I guess other than when he had to, as John Pertwee.
They wouldn't make an episode of him being slowed down. It wouldn't be entertaining.
Yeah, that would be a great episode. And here's the doctor, drinking his tea, reading his H.G. Wells, you know.
That's a very expensive piece of coinage.
Yes.
Once you know it's coming, it's written in stone. You can't rewrite history.
Mm-hmm.
You can't rewrite what's written in stone.
Yep.
Something, he's mentioned this before, some things are written in stone. You cannot change them.
Right.
But he knows of things that you can change, and he decides what the rules are in this. We saw that in the Pompeii episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Pompeii has to be written. You know, sort of like, you know, if Napoleon won the Battle of Waterloo.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't know how, I mean, I'm sure it's just another literary device here, mm-hmm. saying what, you know, sort of willy-nilly, this one is written in stone. See, I see Rory Williams' name on the gravestone. This has to happen.
Yeah.
Instead of when, in previous episodes, you saw him mention Back to the Future and how you'll just kind of like disappear and they got it right. And
yeah, yeah. Yeah, That's something where I don't think it's just with Moffat, but I think there's been a lot of writers. I think especially back with the older seasons, as in, you know, back like 80s and prior,
mm-hmm.
Where because they had all these different writers writing the serials, that's something I think has always gone back and forth. You know, where one episode will say, oh, you know, this is going to happen, we can't change it, but then, you know, the next serial, next set of stories or next set of episodes for the story, it would be the complete opposite, where it was all about changing, you know, what was happening.
Right.
I mean, the interesting ones are the ones where, you know, the doctor thinks that he's changing everything, and then all of a sudden you find out that, like,
the reason
surprise,
it
you didn't.
Is because it
yeah.
was him
yep.
trying to.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's just, there was even one in particular I'm trying to think of where, like, blatantly he thought that he was changing it, but all that he did was actually make it what it was supposed to be. Maybe it was even Pompeii I'm thinking of. No, I guess not.
That's how they got the word volcano, because a few people lived.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he actually, Angel Islington
mm-hmm.
from Neverwhere,
yeah.
Neil Gaiman's miniseries.
Right, right. But no. Yeah, I mean, and then that's just always been something
Gaiman,
I think
sorry.
Was, yeah. That's just one of those things I think has always been really tough with that show, is the whole idea of whether things can or cannot be changed.
Yeah.
You know, the excuses that they give every time something comes up that, oh, well, this has already been, you know, whatever, with this episode, it was, you read it now, so now it has to happen. Yeah, it's weird to think that, because it's, you end up in that paradoxical loop, because he tore out the last page, so did the last page always have the afterword on it, or was the afterword only added once they, you know, destroyed the angel's loop with the paradox?
It was afterward, because he asked River Song. Well, Riversong asked Amy to write an afterword for the doctor on the last page.
Yeah. Well, but at the same time, the fact that the book existed at all before, you know, before River went back. Exactly. So it's just one of those interesting things you look at and you say, try to wrap your head around it. And it, you know, kind of turns into...
Donnie Darko.
Yeah. Donnie Darko is one of the examples I would give.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, yeah, it's really weird.
Nobody should die alone.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, I don't know. It's always strange. It's always strange the way that happens. You look at the other TV shows and movies and stuff like that have tried to play into that as well. The whole idea of, you know, asking for something and trying to change something and having it not change at all. Like, my wife recently watched one of the old Twilight Zone episodes where the guy finds the man in the lamp. It's like the Magic Genie episode. So he says he wants to be a dictatorial ruler that can't be taken from power. Over an eastern country or something like that. And so the genie all of a sudden transports him, and next thing you know, he's Hitler at the end of his reign. So it ends up being that he kills him, you know, that Hitler killed himself because he actually wasn't Hitler anymore. He was actually this guy that wished to be this dictator.
Very good.
So, you know, but just one of those things where it's interesting the way some people will play on that whole idea.
I've never seen that episode. I'm shocked.
Yeah, it was an interesting one.
To be honest with you, I thought I had every episode.
Yeah, I don't know. It was a good one. His first wish was to fix a piece of glass on a display case he had. And so when all the rest of the story was done, when he came back from being Hitler, when he didn't have his money anymore, he says, well, at least we got this, you know, at least the glass in the case was fixed. And they were all, oh, that's great. And he turns around and the broom goes through the glass. So, you know, it still ended up being the way it was before anything got fixed. So, but it's just interesting. Just another example of people trying to show that whole... Yeah, the whole concept of Matrix, things that can't be changed.
When Neo speaks to the Oracle, and she says, and don't worry about the glass face or whatever. And,
yeah, yeah.
And he breaks it, and then she's like, what's really going to crack your noodle later, or your egg later, or something like that?
Yeah.
Would you have broken it if I hadn't said anything?
Yep. Yeah. I always love that when people do that, though.
Right.
It's just like when you start when you have to think about what came first. It's still the old chicken and the egg thing, but the way that people play on it is just... awesome sometimes.
We get something else in this episode. Rory has this decision that he has to make, whether to throw himself off the building or not and create the paradox. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to bring this up because to me, I think the writer treads a dangerous line right here because basically you're telling the audience that, all right, let me set the stage first. We had the Van Gogh episode. Mm-hmm. Where there was a hotline afterwards for people who had suicidal thoughts. In this episode, we have something positive happening because of suicide.
Yeah.
And the two basically committing suicide together. Would you say it's a suicide, thinking that if you throw yourself off, it's going to create the paradox and you have a chance to live? Or would it be more of a suicide to stay in the building? And I'm sure this is what the writer... you know, had to weigh in his mind.
Right, right. Well, it's tough to call because I guess in a way Rory wouldn't be killing himself outright by staying in the building and just letting it happen the way it happened. I guess he was looking at the fact that, well, the three of you are here with me as well, so we don't know what would have happened if he had just stayed there.
Right.
You know, won't harp too much on the whole, you know, Centaurian thing because... as it is, didn't make any sense for him to age all of a sudden now, after he had lived 2,000 years in the crypt without aging. But
unless when Amy recreated the universe.
Yeah, I guess maybe he got reset or something like that, and is, you know, I don't know. But yeah, no, that's an interesting point because I think there are a lot of people in the world that actually do think that, you know, committing suicide will make things better for everybody
Especially if you're going to save someone else.
Yeah, yeah.
And...
But it's tough because you can get into a much deeper theological thing if you really wanted to on that. But we'll save that for another discussion.
That's very true.
Another podcast.
And him saying, you think you'll just come back to life. When don't I?
Yeah.
He's like, when don't I come back to life?
Mm-hmm.
And so he has a faithfulness in his own eternity, you know, sort of like the face of Bo.
Right, right.
you know, which I thought was interesting that he just kind of figured that he's never going, he feels immortal. That's why he can go up to the Cybermen and say, do I need to demonstrate anymore?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, when their ship blows up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a, it's funny actually that you bring in the whole face of Bo thing, because I felt that that story always was kind of, the way that they played that out in general was another one of those things where it just didn't really make sense ultimately. But yeah, but that definitely has a bit of that, that kind of cockiness with that whole, yeah, when don't I come back to life thing. I mean, it only happened, what, twice or something like that, ultimately. But and I guess he just, he bets too much on that to be the case, I guess, that it's always going to come.
I think it happened once in the history of the world before.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, but it's, yeah, he's funny with that. Just the, and just he, that yeah, whole idea.
It twice, you know, or transmuted or
yeah,
you know, however, yeah. Whatever, metaphor that it would be. Mm-hmm. Just interesting too. Is that Rory here? I want to talk about him as a companion, because to be honest with you, Rob, I'm really not very sad that Amy is gone. I mean, I'll miss the boots occasionally, you know, but Rory is, to me, such a strong companion.
Yeah, yeah.
And to see Rory go, and I know Rory's attached at the hip to,
yeah, Amy. To Amy. Yeah.
You know, he's Rory Pond.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree, though. It's kind of sad. You almost wish that he that the last Centaurian, the whole thing of him being an Auton and not dying would actually turn out to be the case, because it would be awesome to see him stick around, because there are a couple of like classic episodes I can think of where like Rory would have been an awesome person to have there with them. Even the whole, you know, the Happiness Patrol that we just watched the other day, I could totally picture like Rory being there, like with Ace, like running around, like, what are you doing? You can't set off charges in here and stuff.
Well, see, that's what I like about Rory too, is he always questioned the Doctor. Stop trying to make me. Stop trying to make me like you. You're mm-hmm. turning me into someone that I'm not. Right. Rory always had such a, I said had, and that's just sad to me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's not have anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Rory always had such a firm grasp on his identity,
right?
You know, so that he was a strong character because of that. The Doctor wasn't going to mold him into what he needed.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems so often, like Donna Noble once said to the Doctor, "Well, you just make everyone soldiers," when she saw Martha Jones,
right?
And
right.
the way that she was involved in UNIT.
Mm-hmm.
And it just seems to me that Rory was the best kind of soldier
mm-hmm.
because he did it out of a valiant heart,
right?
More than anything else, not out of, and his love.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't as if he was, and Martha Jones is another great example of someone with a valiant heart.
Yeah, definitely.
And I guess that's why I won't be as sad with Amy Pond leaving, is because I always kind of felt this was her raggedy man that she always knew from a child, and she had her little fantasy pictures with him,
mm-hmm.
and kind of, she kind of made the Doctor into something that he might not have been.
Right, right. Yeah, well, that's the problem too, with all the time that she had from when she first met him to when she grew up and, you know, saw him again. She had all that time to develop what she thought it would be like to be with him. And right. then that even once they started doing things together, I don't think they've necessarily portrayed that conflict enough of him not being who she thought he was, but she kept enough of that, I think, the childish expectation of what was going to happen. I mean, come on, the first episode, he takes her to some, you know, intergalactic banquet or something like that. So I guess he just kind of plays right into what she expected of him. But, yeah, I definitely think that Rory was much more, I don't want to say that he expected to be able to stay who he was as much, but he definitely, whether it's because he was ignorant of all of what was going on, or just he was that steadfast in being who he was, that, yeah, there was definitely no bones about him just, I'm going to be who I am. You know, and like you said, you're not going to change me into what you expect me to be. I'm still Rory Williams, and,
right,
you know, a bit of a goofball, but, you know, doing what has to get done when it needs to get done.
Yeah,
you know?
And he has the courage because he's doing what needs to be done in the face of fear,
mm-hmm.
you know, too. So I thought it was interesting when the Doctor actually said, do you ever think about your 2,000 years?
Yeah.
You know, and And he kind of played it off at first and then said mm-hmm. it was sort of like a door in his mind that he could go to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there is that other side to Rory, which makes him a much more layered character.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and being so, I think it's harder to see the problem. Well, it's not a problem. It's a good thing that a lot of the newer episodes have such good character development and you care so much about these people. It's harder to see them go, and you're upset when they go in a way that just doesn't seem right.
Right, yeah.
You know, and I think that's what happens here is because it seems like a fancy little footwork by the writer to try to write them out of the story.
Right, right.
When in fact, you wouldn't have been as upset when Joe Grant goes and gets a boyfriend and mm-hmm. says bye, doctor.
Yeah.
You know, you wouldn't be as upset when Tom Baker, you know, I'm sure, I mean, we're all upset when Sarah Jane left.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you were ready to move on, too. She was there since John Pertwee.
Exactly. So. Yeah. I think it's, yeah, even looking at, like, Matthew Waterhouse, when Adric left, mm-hmm. as sad as it was, you know, him giving up his life for the doctor and his companions, still, the only thing you really knew as far as backstory to Adric and, you know, character development was his episode where he came in.
Circle.
You know, where you saw where he came from. Other than that, I mean, how much depth really was there to him, you know?
his last episode was one of those that you had mentioned earlier, basically, mm-hmm. was how history is written by the actions of the Doctor.
Right.
Adric was in a cyber ship, which crashed into the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
As Adric couldn't move it and he's plummeting to the Earth, he creates the explosion that kills the dinosaurs.
Yep.
So it was actually the Doctor and his inability to, and that was when I believe the TARDIS couldn't go where he wanted it to as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So there was less control over how he ended up where.
Yeah. Well, it's even kind of like Terminus kind of touched on that a little bit. The whole idea that the Big Bang, that the creation of the quote-unquote creation of the universe was that fuel cell from this leper colony ship exploding at the center of the universe. And
The Doctor is a major character in two Big Bangs.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because he has in the Pandoricum, too,
mm-hmm.
where he creates the Big Bang to start reset the universe.
Yep, yep. Yeah, it's another one of those, where it's kind of funny when you take it in retrospect to an older episode and the way that they played into it. I thought they were going to play into that even more about Terminus, because the fact that they already had it set up where they had already explored the ship that had created the Big Bang. You know, they had already explained the Big Bang. I totally thought they were going to tie that back in and have one of those like, oh, I remember now. It was, you know, Terminus. I totally was waiting for that and, you know, making a joke about the Minotaur, like, being inside the ship and, you know, how all those stories, you know, some of the Greek mythology and stuff came out of that. But they kind of let that drop, and I was upset about that a little bit. But
I don't know. Because it was the second Big Bang. The first one, we have the world that Amy Pond comes from, and then we have the reset.
Exactly. Then the other one.
Amy has to remember the Doctor, something old, something new, something.
Yeah.
You know, something given, something blue.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which was neat on the TARDIS.
Yeah, that was cool. Cool. Yeah, but yeah.
Next episode, The Snowmen.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get into that. I'm Barry Jensen,
and I'm Rob Tiedemann.
Signing out.
Bye bye.